I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The CDC is telling pregnant women to avoid traveling to a neighborhood in Miami because of an increasing number of cases of Zika. 10 new cases were identified in the last few days and one more yesterday in a different Miami neighborhood. Meanwhile, new cases of Zika in Puerto Rico are off the charts, with thousands of people being infected every day. Our guest, Donald G. McNeil, Jr., has been tracking Zika since it was identified in Brazil last year. He's global health reporter for The New York Times, wrote a book called Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. And Donald, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what do we know about this neighborhood in Miami? It's been identified as Wynwood.
I haven't been to the neighborhood in Miami, but I gather it's sort of an up-and-coming kind of hip neighborhood of, gentrifying and art galleries and restaurants and things like that. And the first cases, there were cases in Florida, and one of the things that was unusual, they realized they had cases in different places, and they finally put together the connection that people were being infected at work rather than at home. And so they were able to concentrate on this neighborhood.
And we're talking about homegrown cases and what, local mosquitoes?
Homegrown cases and local Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, yes. And it turns out that even though they've done intensive mosquito fighting in the neighborhood for a few weeks now, since early July, there are still more Aedes aegypti mosquitoes in the neighborhood than they expected. So they don't really know where they're breeding and how. I frankly think, the health authorities are kind of kidding themselves that they're going to be able to say that the problem is going to be kept just to this neighborhood. I think, frankly, eventually they're going to have to admit that it's all over Miami.
Wow.
It's very hard to believe that people don't travel more than a mile, and mosquitoes, get picked up by the breeze and blow distances too. The average mosquito travels only about 150 yards in its life, but some mosquitoes go farther.
We heard reports of aerial spraying in this particular neighborhood in Miami, inspectors talking to people, giving out repellents even to homeless people. Is that going to be effective, do you think?
I mean, giving repellents to homeless people is a PR exercise. The only people who are seriously in danger from this disease are pregnant women. And the problem is getting people to take it seriously. I was just in Puerto Rico a week ago, and I met pregnant women who were taking Zika classes, and they were 9 months or nearly 9 months pregnant, and they were wearing, tiny outfits and not wearing any mosquito repellent. It's very tough to get people to take a threat seriously until they've seen someone they know actually damaged by it. So in the early days of an epidemic, there's an enormous amount of sort of poo-pooing and denial. And, we'll see what happens. People have to take it seriously, and they can't wait 9 months in order to begin taking it seriously when they see microcephaly appearing here.
And what we also know is about half of pregnancies are unintended. People that didn't plan to get pregnant, but they become pregnant.
Well, I'm always a little suspicious of that figure because, lots of people are, in the United States, my first baby was unplanned and that we didn't plan it down to the minute, but we were happy when it happened. But, the truth is that women don't always know during the first few weeks that they are pregnant and that, the first trimester is the most dangerous period in Zika. Not that there's no risk towards the end of the pregnancy. And so it's important to not be in the area where that disease is being transmitted if you're pregnant. Other than that, it's not very threatening.
Well, I wanted to pick up on that because I think sometimes we lump all this stuff together. So if you're not pregnant, you're not planning on getting pregnant, you're pretty sure you're not going to get pregnant in the next couple of months, then don't worry about Zika. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's a mild disease in 99.9% of all cases. And in fact, since there's no vaccine, getting a mild case of the disease in its own way the perfect vaccine. Once a woman has had the disease and has recovered from it, she can then safely have a baby. Cases have disappeared on the islands in the Pacific where it was raging in 2007 and 2013. There hasn't been a case since, and Colombia has declared its epidemic virtually over. You get an intense amount of transmission, and then it eventually burns itself out because everyone's immune. We don't expect that. No one expects that to happen in Florida because there'll never likely to be incredibly intense transmission because people live in air-conditioned homes and drive in air-conditioned cars, and it's not like the slums of Brazil.
Right.
But for the unlucky person, there's the possibility of getting infected during pregnancy.
We've done several shows on Zika, and one of the things we've learned is that it breeds in water. There's even a bottle cap that's, on the street that has water in it, or tires or garbage or things like that, that seems to be the breeding ground for Zika. Is that true?
Yeah, it breeds in clean, fresh water, you know, and water that doesn't dry up after a few days. So, you know, it doesn't breed in canals or swamps or things like that. It breeds it, but it breeds very easily in garden bird baths and in swimming pools that haven't been chlorinated and in people's gutters where water backs up. You know, the larvae take some days to develop it, so they don't breed in a puddle that dries up after a rain shower, but they definitely breed in places where water stands. And you can have water hidden even inside a plant in your garden and not realize that mosquitoes are breeding in there. So it's really, really tough to get rid of Aedes aegypti unless you can literally march into every garden in the neighborhood, whether people like it or not, you know, spray larvicide all over the place. And, you know, we're a well-armed population and lots of people don't want, you know, health agents walk into their backyard and saying, you know, we don't care if you like it or not, we're planning to spray your garden. So it's real tough to beat this mosquito.
It certainly is. And does the virus, or the Zika virus, does that stay in the body? I mean, some viruses do. Does the body essentially fight it off?
Almost everyone we know about, except for pregnant women, gets the disease, is cured within about 2 weeks, and then after that you have antibodies and you have what appears to be long-lasting immunity to it. We don't know if it's lifelong immunity because nobody studied the disease long enough, but it appears to be quite strong, effective immunity afterwards. Most diseases are like that. I mean, you know, measles, chickenpox, smallpox, diseases like that, you get it, you recover from it, you're safe in those cases for the rest of your life.
But should we be afraid, very afraid?
You know, this sounds like a headline from a horror movie.
It does. I'm just checking. I mean, there's a lot of...
Pregnant women should be extremely alert to this. Everybody else, I think, should not worry. And people who are the sexual partners of pregnant women need to be alert to this. The disease, you can get it and pass it on to your girlfriend or wife without you realizing you've had it. So that's a serious issue. I mean, the threat is to the fetus, even young children. I mean, I had a friend asking about 11-month-old child they were thinking of taking to Florida. And the answer seems to be the child is going to be fine, but I mean, as far as we know. But it's developing fetuses that are the ones that are at serious risk. And there's a small risk of this thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome, but that's a 1 in 5,000 chance or so.
And can girlfriends and wives transmit it to the men or perhaps women in their lives?
There's only one known case of that, and it was kind of a freakish case. So it's not – I mean, it's theoretically possible, but it doesn't seem like a major risk. I mean, yeah, they have to – the CDC has to put it down on their list of possibilities because it's one known case. But it was an unusual case of sexual transmission from a woman to a man.
Let me just quickly reintroduce – that's Donald G. McNeil, Jr., and he's the author of a book. Came out just very recently, Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. He's global health reporter for The New York Times, focusing in this portion of Radio Times on some new cases of Zika in Florida that have been identified. Our guest has also been covering Zika in Puerto Rico. I want to talk about that as well. In the meantime, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Looking at something you wrote last week, just four cases. This was, you say, in Puerto Rico, officials believe thousands of residents, including up to 50 pregnant women, are infected each day. Each day.
Yep. And that's part of the state of the denial. I mean, the official case count is around 5,000 cases on an island of 3.5 million. And, you know, I think it's 500 and something pregnant women. But the truth is that the labs, so few people go to the doctor to get tested, and the labs doing the testing are so completely backed up that the official case count has nothing to do with the real case count. And the real case count is probably several thousand citizens per day and maybe up to 50 pregnant women. That calculation was based on the standard birth rate of Puerto Rico, which is about 32,000 babies a year. Mm-hmm. But it's probably lower because the birth rate of Puerto Rico is plummeting because women are choosing not to have children, which may be the only way they can protect themselves against getting infected there, because mosquito control is a flop in Puerto Rico. All the talk that they did back in February about all the great stuff they were going to do about getting rid of standing water in gardens and spraying homes and stuff did not work. And the mosquito is transmitting the disease in all 78 municipalities on the island. So,
is it a flop because we know Puerto Rico has a financial crisis, has people leaving the island? I mean, in many ways, it's dealing with a whole host of challenges and problems.
It's partially because of financial problems, but it's also because this mosquito is really tough to beat. I mean, I've been asking the World Health Organization, show me one town anywhere in the Western Hemisphere that can safely say, we've controlled the mosquito so well that our women are safe. And I said, I want to go to that town and write an article about how they did it. Mm-hmm. They cannot name a single place, no country, no island, no township. Maybe Miami will be the first place that succeeds in beating the mosquito, but we'll have to see. The problem is the mosquito lives in people's gardens and slips into their houses following the trail of carbon dioxide. It'll breed in your shower drain if it can. They're very attracted. They're basically entirely attracted to humans. And you can have one house in a neighborhood where they refuse to let inspectors in, and they will breed enough mosquitoes to cover the entire neighborhood. So unless you march in with the army, which is what Fred Soper did in Brazil and a bunch of other countries back in the 1930s, the one time they almost beat the mosquito, they were using absolute police state tactics in order to fight the mosquito. And we don't do that anymore. Public health doesn't depend on police powers the way it did back in the bad old days.
Do screens work? The good old days, depending on your point of view.
Yeah.
But things like screens to keep the mosquito
screens
out of
work,
the house?
But I'm sure you've been inside a place with screens on the windows and you still had mosquitoes inside with you.
Sure.
Screens aren't perfect, and air conditioning works too. Keeps it too cold for mosquitoes to fly, but they're not perfect. And you have to walk outside in order to get to your car, and you can still get bitten by a mosquito inside an air-conditioned car. They make a big difference in transmission, but they're not perfect. And Puerto Rico has many more, houses that don't use screens, that have just sort of louvered windows to keep out the sun. They have a lot of schools that are like that. It's a less screened and air-conditioned society than South Florida, partially because of poverty and partially because of habits of living on a tropical island.
Your book begins with Rio de Janeiro. As we know, the Olympics are going to begin in a couple of days. Some people have said they're not going because of the threat of Zika. What do you anticipate when the Olympics are over? Do you think we're going to see more cases of Zika?
Well, my book actually begins with northeast Brazil, not with Rio. Rio is as far south of the equator as Miami is north of the equator. You have to remember that Brazil is a really big country. And Rio is having its winter right now.
Ah, yes.
Now, winter there is in the 70s rather than in the, it's not Jack Frost and snowman territory, but mosquito transmission goes way down in their winter. And also, they had an epidemic earlier this year during their summer, so there's a lot of herd immunity in Rio. So I'm not that worried. The idea that, first of all, many of the countries that the mosquito that people will be traveling back from already have the disease. Others don't have the mosquito that transmits the disease. So I imagine some people will get it. I think pregnant women, I think the CDC thinks and WHO thinks, more importantly, pregnant women should stay away. But other people, it's not that high a risk. So I'm not worried about any big disaster from Rio. I think the fears of that have been overblown. I've been very cynical about all the male golfers who said they're not going because of Zika. A lot of them want to play in the FedEx Cup, which is worth $10 million, and they need to keep their points on the board in order to play in the FedEx Cup.
And that's a whole other issue. No, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Donald G. McNeil Jr. again has been tracking Zika, writing about Zika. He's global health reporter for the New York Times, author of a book called Zika, the Emerging Epidemic. Well, we'll be talking after this very short break about sexual inactivity among young adults. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You know all those reports and news stories about the hookup culture, 20-somethings having lots of sex with lots of different people? Well, it may be more of a myth than a reality. Our guest, Gene Twenge, is a psychology professor at San Diego State University, and one of the authors of a new study about sexual inactivity among young adults. It's published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior. She wrote a book called Generation Me and joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, I'm sure folks want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Gene, what's the main finding of your research?
So we found that young adults, so 20 to 24-year-olds, born in the 1990s, about 15% of them said they had had no sexual partner since age 18. And that's a lot higher for Gen Xers born in the late 1960s. When they were 20 to 24, only 6% had had no sexual partners as an adult.
So what does that tell us? I mean, besides many things, but what's the thing that jumps out at you first?
So we had done a previous study looking at number of sexual partners because, of course, there had been lots of rumors about the millennial generation hooking up, having lots of partners. And we were curious, you know, what would show up in a big national survey like this one that has data going all the way back to 1989 on sexual partners for adults. And we looked at this, controlling for age, so taking that out of the equation, and found, to our surprise, that millennials actually reported having fewer sexual partners than Gen Xers. So that made me wonder if that was partially due to some millennials not having sex at all, mm-hmm. and it appears that that's the case.
In fact, there was the CDC and some other reports talking about more virgins in high school in grades 9 through 12.
Exactly. So that is very consistent with this. It shows that among high school students, by their survey, they found back in 1991, the average high school student had sex, so 54% of high school students back then, that was the Gen X era, had sexual intercourse. But then in 2015, the most recent data, that number had gone down to 41%. So combining their data and ours, it suggests that millennials, especially those born more recently, those born in the 90s, are putting off sex until later.
Well, I'm sure there's several explanations, and you cover some of them in this report. One is that some are living at home with mom and dad, which might not be the most conducive environment for having sex. I wonder whether sex education has anything to do with it, or abstinence education, or whether things like screens are replacing the, maybe the kind of person-to-person contact or sexual activity that people might be having.
Yeah, there's a lot of possible causes. So the data on sex education and abstinence-only education and so on is a little muddled. It's kind of hard to tell what effect that may have had. And then with screens, I think that's a possibility, you know, to put it in a short sentence, why they're not having sex, they're on their phones.
Right.
Of course, you can find partners with your phone through apps like Tinder. So I think some of that is it's more a matter of choice, that the technology, it may be an enabler rather than a direct cause. You know, if you want to use the technology to communicate with people online and not in person, then you probably have less sex. But if you want to find a partner with it, you can do that too.
How do people, though, define sex? And it seems to me there could be a number of different ways. If people are being asked, have you had sex in the last 6 months, you might get a yes or no describing the same activity.
Yeah. So this particular survey leaves that fairly open-ended. It asks, you know, how many people have you had sex with? And it doesn't define the exact activity. There's some advantages to that approach because then you're not getting too graphic and, you know, you can maybe ensure a more honest response. But it is true that in this particular survey, we can't tell the difference between, you know, say, you know, more traditional intercourse than oral sex. One advantage of asking the question that way is it's more inclusive of different activities. So the respondent, him or herself, can define what they think is a sexual partner. I don't think that's going to have a whole lot of impact on our results, though, because if anything, oral sex has become more common over the generations, and that would push for millennials having more sexual partners if that's how they were defining it.
But that does raise a question about how a person defines something like oral sex, whether they think that that is sexual or not.
Yep, and that is something that we can't really nail down in this particular data set.
How does this compare to boomers, who might be either the parents or perhaps even the grandparents of some of these young people we're talking about?
Well, in this particular study, we you know, did look in one part of it at those in the boomer generation, so those born in the 40s and 50s. And from that, it looks like their sexual inactivity was about the same as those born in the 80s. But those born in the 90s were actually more likely to be sexually inactive than their parents' generation of the boomers born in the 50s, and especially the boomers and Gen Xers born in the 1960s, who had a very low rate of sexual inactivity.
And so, I mean, again, so interesting to when you compare generations and sexual either activity or inactivity.
Well, you know, I think one thing that we have to keep in mind is that boomers, on average, married at a pretty, what would now be considered a very young age. The average woman in 1970 got married when she was 21. And even in 1980, it was, I think, 23. So, and now it's up to 27. Right. So there's a real difference in the life course now at the age in which people do things, that they get married later, they have kids later, they settle into careers later. So Gen Xers started that trend, but they were also having sex a little bit earlier than boomers. So what millennials have done, especially those born later in the 90s, so millennials and the generation after them, who I'd like to call iGen, they are putting everything off. The whole reproductive trajectory is pushed until later.
Including having sex.
Including having sex, from that data, you know, here with young adults, and then also from the teenagers.
Do they not like it, or they don't want it? Does the survey get into some of the motivations or feelings about sex?
It doesn't really, you know, so we can only speculate about what some of those might be. So there's some possible causes that get to that question. So, for example, some people have speculated that the widespread availability of pornography paradoxically might make people more satisfied. Instead of that ramping people up to go have real sex, that may be enough for them. There's some young men of this generation who are reporting that porn has kind of ruined real sex for them, that they can only get excited from porn and not from real sex. There's other possible causes, though, that I think we can kind of rule out. So there's been some speculation about this study. I've read a few people who have said, oh, they're too busy to have sex, or too busy working.
I read that, yes.
Too busy studying. Well, it makes no sense on several levels. First, because we're looking at people who can have one partner. It can be one partner at one time. That doesn't take that much time. Second, young people today are working less and studying less than previous generations. We know from several studies about study time and homework time for high school students and college students, and then the employment rate is actually lower now for both teenagers and young adults than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Do you see a difference between men and women and sexual inactivity or activity?
So we found that the shift toward more sexual inactivity was stronger for women. So the percentage who are sexually inactive, that increase between those born in the 60s, those born in the 90s, it was a tripling for women and nearly doubling for men. So this effect of more sexual inactivity was driven more by women than by men, although the effects still showed up for men as well.
I know this is a lot of what your research is based on. Are people honest when they answer a survey about their sexual lives?
Well, this survey, the general social survey, is very well designed, and they really know what they're doing. It's administered by one of the most respected survey organizations in the country, NORC, at the University of Chicago. And they, for these sexual partner questions, they're asked anonymously. They take every step possible to try to ensure an honest response. Of course, this is a sensitive issue.
Sure.
The interesting thing with the general social survey is that the people who administer it have observed over the years that people seem to be fairly willing to answer questions about sex. It's when you ask them about their income that they don't want to be honest or forthcoming.
Such a good thing to keep in mind. That's Jean Twenge. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Wrote a book called Generation Me, and one of the authors of a new study about sexual inactivity among young adults, looking specifically at millennials and Generation X, and it's published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior. And you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Let me read some comments at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweeting us also at WHYY Radio Times. A question from Thomas from Bryn Mawr. What role does masturbation play in this decline of sex for millennials? Do we know the answer to that?
We don't know from this data, but some of the more anecdotal evidence around pornography suggests that it could be playing a role. Maybe that's what's going on instead of real sex.
Also, a tweet from Nathan. In my experience, apps like Tinder and Grindr have made sex as easy as ordering a pizza safely, of course. And we've done some shows about some of these hookup apps. Can we also say, I mean, it seems like they are also thriving in this environment as well. There was that Vanity Fair story that, you know, sort of made it almost seem like this crisis at hand.
Yeah, and that Vanity Fair story had no data in it, I would like to point out.
It was very anecdotal.
It was all anecdote.
And I think you were kind of buried in there somewhere, or some of your research.
Yes, it was mentioned very parenthetically and didn't go into any kind of detail, I suspect, because it wasn't consistent with her thesis that she had from the beginning. From what she told me, because I talked to the reporter, she said, oh, but, you know, I've gone around to all of these bars and talked to people, so it's got to be here. Well, of course, because that's the population of people who are hooking up.
Right.
And there's a certain population in every generation who's going to be the ones who are interested in hooking up in promiscuity and so on. That was true among the boomers. They had free love and they had bars and they had lots of other places and ways to meet people. But that's not the majority of the population. And I think there's also a segment and perhaps even a larger segment of this generation who's been left out of that culture. So one possibility, for example, is there's some data suggesting that those apps place a lot of emphasis on physical appearance. You know, you see a picture, you swipe left or right.
Right.
If in a previous generation, let's say you're not conventionally attractive, you meet someone in a bar, you can charm someone with your humor and personality. With these apps, that's not really possible.
Let me read a question, actually a question from Martin, who says, I'm curious if the changing demographics of America have also changed our understanding of sex and its appropriateness and place in society. Did your study factor in racial differences, particularly immigrants, as well as religious / cultural differences? Were you able to look at that?
So we did take a look at that. So one way to in any of these studies, the numbers of people in very specific groups are going to be small. So the easiest way to look at this is to say, okay, let's just look at white participants and see how they change over time. And the change was virtually identical to what we found in the whole sample.
Huh.
So that strongly suggests that this trend is not caused by, for example, you know, large numbers of say Asian immigrants. That's clearly not the cause here, or Latino immigrants. So if you just look at white non-Hispanics, you see virtually the same effect. We did look at religion and found that the shift over time was a little bit larger for religious individuals compared to those who are not religious. But if you break it down, both groups show the same trend.
And what about things like affairs? Someone who's married and might also be having sexual partners outside of the marriage or perhaps the long-term committed relationship. Is that a factor?
Well, here we were very specifically focused on having just one sexual partner. So presumably if you're married, that's a box is already checked.
And what about college campuses? Again, that's often the place where everyone is hooking up, to use that stereotype. Any takeaways from that?
Well, there was a previous study that looked at number of sexual partners among those who had attended college for at least a year. And they used the same data set, and they found just as we did that there were fewer sexual partners among millennials who'd gone to college compared to previous generations who had.
Hmm.
So it's pretty consistent across both college and non-college, and it looks like that the idea of there being the big hookup culture, at least hookup culture involving sex rather than, say, making out, well, it might be there, but again, it's a certain segment of the population, and there's actually more who are not participating in it. You know, I think there's some other trends that might be worth mentioning here to kind of put this in context.
Absolutely.
This generation, especially those born in the 90s, the late millennials and then the iGeners born after 95, they are a very cautious generation. They are much less likely to, for example, to drink alcohol compared to Gen Xers and boomers at the same age, at least one when they are teenagers and 20. So once they hit 21, you know, kind of all bets are off. But during their high school and college years, they're less likely to drink. There's the whole movement of substance-free dorms and so on. So these choices of being much more cautious are more acceptable. It kind of goes against the stereotype we have of, you know, young people kind of running amok. This generation is a lot less likely to do that as young adults than previous generations were.
Do you think it's healthier to wait to have sex, to be more cautious about sex?
I think that you know, it depends on the individual and what they're ready for.
And how about things like, are young people then who are, let's say, virgins, are they waiting until they get married to have sex, or they're just waiting into later 20s or maybe even 30s?
Well, most of them don't appear to be waiting, no. And this generation's attitude toward premarital sex is the most accepting of any generation. Some of those more religious folks might be waiting, but there's fewer who are very religious among this generation. The percentage who not just affiliate with a religion, but go to religious services or even believe in God, we found in a previous paper in this with this same data set, is much lower, you know, among this group.
And so
one of the key factors here is that there's just more acceptance of different choices. So one of the biggest cultural changes we've seen in the U.S. is more individualism, more focus on the self, and less on social rules. It's why I call my book about the millennials Generation Me. And you can see the negatives on that, but there's also the big positive. Treat people as individuals. Well, if they want to be asexual, or if they want to wait for marriage, or if they want to use Tinder and hook up a lot, those choices are all considered acceptable.
That's the perfect place to end our conversation. Jean Twenge, thanks again for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Psychology professor at San Diego State University, just mentioned, author of a book called Generation Me. And again, one of the authors of a new study about sexual inactivity among young adults published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior. We're going to shift gears once again. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about New Jersey and its gas tax. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, if you live in Pennsylvania and you drive to New Jersey, you should tank up your car. Gas is so much cheaper in the Garden State. That could change if the Assembly and Governor Christie come to an agreement over a proposed gas tax hike. The Transportation Trust Fund is depleted, on empty, if you will, and infrastructure projects have been put on hold, at least for now. But it looks like the sides are far apart and there are complications. We asked Ryan Hutchins to join us. He's Politico's New Jersey bureau chief. He covers the state legislature, Governor Christie, and a wide range of politics and policy stories in New Jersey. And Ryan, joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Shifting gears from from sex to New Jersey and its gas tax. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Ryan, what is the current gas tax in New Jersey?
The current gas tax is 14.5 cents per gallon, and it's been that way since the 1980s. It's kind of the third rail of politics in New Jersey. Nobody wants to raise the gas tax. And the ironic thing is it looks like Governor Chris Christie, Republican governor who hasn't raised any taxes, might be the one who has to do it.
So interesting. Now, how much do they want to – what is the proposed gas tax hike in New Jersey?
So pretty much everyone's on the same page that we would increase it 23 cents to about 37.5 cents per gallon.
Would that be, I don't know if you buy gas in Pennsylvania, but would that be kind of equivalent to what's being paid in other states, or does that still put New Jersey below the national average for a gas tax?
I don't know about the national average. I think it would still be less than. There's different ways to measure gas taxes state to state, but I think it would still be less than Pennsylvania. You know, but it might be enough that some people who might drive across the border now just to fill up in New Jersey might consider
maybe not.
You know, not doing it.
All right. So what does Governor Christie want in exchange for increasing the gas tax?
Yeah. So what Governor Christie wants is he calls it tax fairness. Right now he's been getting a one cut in the sales tax to to offset for the average person that,
you know,
that
extra. Ryan, I got to jump in here only because we're missing every other word. We do have you on Skype. I'm not sure. Maybe the best thing we can do is to put you on a cell. But let's keep talking, and hopefully the Skype will fix itself. You're talking about Governor Christie wanting a 1% cut in the sales tax in New Jersey in order to go for this increase. Do we still have him? No. Let's call him back. All right. That's Skype for you. We are talking about a proposed gas tax hike in New Jersey, the third of three guests in this hour on Radio Times. We began by talking about Zika. We were talking in the last segment about a really interesting piece of research having to do with sexual inactivity and young adults. And now talking with Ryan Hutchins of Politico's New Jersey bureau chief. And I think we have him back on the air. And Ryan, we're just going to go with a telephone.
Sure. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Not your fault. All right. So we were talking about Governor Christie and what he wanted. He wants a 1% cut in the sales tax in order to go for this increase in the gas tax.
That's right. Combined with some new exemptions on retirement income, some people who receive pension payments or 401k, wouldn't have to pay income taxes. So a penny sales cut in the sales tax doesn't sound a lot, but it adds up to about, with the retirement income, about $1.7 billion per year in revenue that the state would be losing by 2019. And that has some Democrats worried.
Well, because I don't know how big the budget is there, but how much of a sizable cut would that be in the state budget?
The budget is more than $30 billion, $34 billion. So it would be a huge hit. And pretty much everyone concedes it would mean you're going to have to cut things. You're going to have to make cuts. And some people worry that we could be talking about cutting aid to school districts, cutting social programs. That's what some of the Democrats in the Senate are worried about, and they have refused to consider that legislation that the governor wants, even though the state assembly had even passed the measure.
Well, now the Transportation Trust Fund, that's where the money from the gas tax, that goes into the trust fund, and that pays for infrastructure projects. Is that down to zero? Is there no money in there?
It's almost down to zero. There's tens of millions of dollars left in a fund that spends $1.6 billion per year. Basically, the governor has issued an order shutting down all non-essential state-funded infrastructure projects in New Jersey. Some that have funding from elsewhere are exempt, and he's set aside some of the remaining money for emergency work where it's necessary. But they're virtually out of money, and this is a crisis that it's been years in the making. Yeah. And they're really on the precipice of something bad happening.
So what are the options as you see these two sides fighting it out?
They're really in quite the stalemate, a stalemate that's complicated by the fact that Democrats are hoping, and this seems like a completely unrelated issue, but Democrats want to guarantee payments into the state pension system. They want to put a question on the ballot this fall asking voters to require quarterly payments into the system. That would lock the state into borrowing billions of dollars a year to make sure it can keep up with those payments until its revenue rises and force it to keep increasing those payments every year. Because of that, the president of the state Senate, Steve Sweeney, who had been the champion of that proposal, says he doesn't want to do both. He says raising the sales tax, he doesn't even want to talk about it on its own. But if he ends up having to concede to the governor, he certainly couldn't do his pension amendment.
Well, because there would be less. You're talking about lowering the sales tax. There would be less revenue, right?
Right. Yep. There would be less revenue. So combined, you're talking about having to find billions of dollars. You're going to have to cut or raise taxes. elsewhere. And Steve Sweeney is a guy who would like to be, he hasn't declared, but he'd like to be the next governor of New Jersey. And wow. He's one of the top candidates.
And people in New Jersey complain about the high taxes, especially the high property taxes.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and so it'd be quite the, for whoever becomes the next governor, if they took both those issues on, there would be a budget crisis of enormous proportions. And they certainly probably wouldn't end up getting a second term. So now this matter has become even so concerning because the Monday is the deadline to place this question on the ballot, this pension question. And Sweeney doesn't want to move forward until he has some clarity on the TTF. So public sector unions, who are crucial support for anyone running for the Democratic nomination for governor, are up in arms over it. And the state teachers union, the New Jersey Education Association, is now saying it's going to withhold financial support to Democratic candidates.
Oh, wow.
Unless this pension amendment appears on the ballot.
Everything is complicated these days. Do you think there's a chance that they could just say, well, let's just raise the gas tax, maybe not 23 cents, but we'll raise it, 22 cents and forget all this other stuff and deal with it later?
There's been talk of that. There's been some lawmakers who've advocated a much smaller increase. There have been some who've said, why don't we just raise the borrowing cap, borrow the money, and deal with it when Chris Christie isn't the governor anymore. So far, the Democratic leaders in the legislature haven't given that a lot of credence. They want to see a robust plan. They want to fix the transportation trust fund so they can have 8 or 10 years where it's set to go, and there'll be funding for transit. $2 billion a year is how much they'd like to spend. And you need to raise the gas tax 23 cents to accomplish that.
And currently it gets about $750 million from the current gas tax. So that'd be a pretty significant increase.
You'd be getting about a $1.1 billion increase in new revenue by the 23 cent increase each year, $1.1 billion.
So the next couple of days are really critical on this particular issue, Ryan?
Yes, and we have really no clarity on what's going to happen. The Speaker of the State Assembly, Vincent Prieto, has said that he thinks it might be time for the governor himself and Sweeney to sit down in a room, three men in a room, and cut a deal. The governor seemed to be headed in that direction yesterday. When he spoke to reporters, Sweeney says he's open to it, but doesn't see what good that would do.
Hmm.
He just can't. It's tough to negotiate with them, he says.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Ryan Hutchins, and he's Politico's New Jersey bureau chief, catching us up on some of the news out of New Jersey, including this fight over a possible increase in the gas tax. If you want to join the conversation, especially if you live in New Jersey, we'd love to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me ask you about Governor Christie. He is clearly not going to be president of the United States. He is a supporter of Donald Trump. Has he made indication if Trump were to become the president of the United States, if he would be part of his administration or his cabinet?
He's clearly interested and open to it. He says his wife would prefer he go into the private sector and make some money. But he's said he'll talk to Donald once he wins the election and see. I mean, there's talk of attorney general. That might be tough. He'd have to, face a hearing before the Senate. And there's a lot that could be talked about there with the so-called Bridgegate scandal where some of his close allies conspired to close lanes to the George Washington Bridge in an act of political retribution against someone who refused to endorse him for re-election. There are other members of his administration now facing, other political allies of his now facing other charges, and his past his immediate past transportation commissioner is appearing in court today on bribery charges.
Wow.
Unrelated to his role as DOT chief.
And doesn't the Bridgegate trial, doesn't that start in the fall?
That's right. That starts in September. If it appears that it's on schedule to start, then they're starting to pick, figure out what jurors they could call. And that's going to, become a theme probably throughout the fall campaign season. So it'll be fresh on people's minds. One other position that people have talked about is White House Chief of Staff. Some people think the governor would be well suited for that position. He'd be in charge of a whole lot of people and would be calling the shots daily. And it's something he likes to do.
Let me read a couple of comments here. Tweet from Amy: moving to New Jersey from Tennessee, all kinds of our taxes went up. So gas is one place where New Jersey is affordable. Ryan, you live in New Jersey. Can you identify with Amy's tweet there?
It is definitely affordable. It has the second lowest gas tax in the nation after oil-rich Alaska. And obviously this is where a lot of oil comes into the United States. And as a result, right now gas here is below $2 per gallon and could even fall more. So it's true. And I think a lot of New Jerseyans are so frustrated. They pay so many taxes. Especially if they own a home and pay property taxes, they feel like this is just one more kick in the teeth. Everything's got to be higher and higher and higher. So there's a lot of frustration there, and a lot of politicians in Trenton who are worried about what the reaction will be for them voting for to increase taxes. Will they be voted out of office as a result of this?
An email from Casey: New Jersey is toll road heaven. Why do they need more tax money? Can you answer that, Ryan? Mm.
Why do they need more tax money? Well,
yeah.
Because the transportation trust fund's been completely mismanaged for years. They've overborrowed. They've basically taken out long-term bonds on. They've taken out loans that last longer than the lifespan of some of the roads and bridges that they've paid for. They've bought equipment with long-term loans, and just doesn't work. They keep refinancing, and now they're just out of money. And all the current gas tax is going to pay debt service, and more money is coming out of the state's general fund to pay for the debt. So there's no – you'd have to raise the gas tax several cents just to pay for the debt they already owe.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Ryan Hutchins, and he's Politico's New Jersey bureau chief, again catching us up on some news coming out of the Garden State. And that's it for today's first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We've got hour two. In fact, I see our guest through the window here for hour two. So do stay with us. We'll be right back.